the city of Chicago is a great city. And I've been there quite a few times, and I adore, even in the winter, it's a fantastic city. What's the most vivid memory of living in, and growing up in Chicago?
Wow. There are so many. I mean, I moved here in 1964 as a six-year-old. I remember going to the old Chicago Stadium and seeing the Blackhawks play when there were six teams in the NHL. That was pretty awesome. I call it in my book, I call it a beer-soaked cathedral of noise. There are no fans like Blackhawks fans. I remember my father it was intense. I loved it. I remember my father taking me to the protests in Lincoln Park in 1968 when the Yippies and Jerry Rubin, and I'm sure that's before your time, when they came to protest at the Democratic National Convention, and there was
not before my time, sir. I remember all of those days.
Very good.
I went to high school at Greenwich Village during the Vietnam protest. So I'm the co-host.
No, that's good. It's good to be speaking to a fellow traveler through the ages. Totally. Thank you for correcting me. I assume everyone is younger than me.
You know how it goes.
Yeah. I remember, this really sticks with me. I remember watching the undercover Chicago cops looking at all the hippies, and they were in tents doing Lord knows what inside their tents. There was a funny smell in the air. Later that night, a rock group came to play called the MC5 from Detroit. We had split by then, but I remember the undercover cops sitting there in their polyester slacks looking around. And they looked like they didn't know how they were going to handle what was starting to brew. And that's interesting, you know, because if we flash forward now to the year 2020 and the protests that broke out in Chicago after George Floyd's death, and then what followed after those protests is just everything went out the window here in Chicago. All semblance of social order, all semblance really of social decency in many ways, considering the crime wave that we're having. It's just quite a continuum over the ages, and the city is still having problems, you know, managing protests, managing political dissent, and there's just a whole lot of hairy stuff going on here in Chicago.
Definitely. So when you brought up the Blackhawks, I grew up as a Ranger fan. So,
me too. As a matter of fact, that first hockey game I went to, Andy Bathgate was still the captain of the Rangers before they traded him to Toronto. That's how far I go back. And yes, I've seen all Blackhawk games, and one of my disfavored Blackhawks was Elbows Nestoranko.
Eric Nestoranko, yes indeed. What an ugly mug, but what great elbow.
Elbow, that's what they nicknamed.
That's so cool. Well, and I mentioned the NHL in my book because, you know, there's a thing going on here. So back in the day when there were, and this relates to city and competition between cities in the modern age and the ability of cities to adapt or fail to adapt. And I see cities like, you know, New York now, and you guys know the landscape much better than I, but it's promising to see a guy. You know Eric Adams better than I do. All I can tell you is he sure looks a hell of a lot better than Bill de Blasio. So
hey,
maybe there
are
some.
Don't sell out Curtis yet. You know, everyone in the city is sick and tired of the crime. And when you think of fighting crime, Curtis Sliwa is the poster boy.
No, I hear you.
I won't sell him out yet. You know,
all right.
Yeah,
I'm
going to
respect that. No, it's not found yet.
The guardian
it's not
angel.
Yet.
who yeah. back in the 70s mm-hmm. when New York was like a madhouse, you know, this is before mm-hmm. Giuliani, the Guardian
right.
Angels took to the subways to protect the commuters. And they've been known and they've been doing that for decades since then. Decades. 50
yeah.
years
yeah.
almost they've been doing it.
Yeah,
so
very
don't tell him out, you know, but I know what you're saying about Eric Adams. He seems to be the only person on the Democrat side would at least have his feet on the ground, for God's sakes, you know, and not up in the air.
Exactly, well, and to me, and that's part of a larger issue, which is the ability of cities to innovate, to welcome and encourage school choice, to get a handle on their finances, to understand that we need more foot patrols, not just cops riding around in cars answering 911 calls. But if you look at where people are moving now, and a lot of people are leaving Chicago, now we have a lot of Latino and Asian influx that's keeping the population right about where it was
right.
at the last census. But blacks and whites are leaving for a lot of good reasons. So they're moving to places like Chattanooga is hot. Who would have thunk it? Nashville is incredibly hot. People are going to Atlanta. They're going to Austin,
right.
Texas, to a million other towns in Texas. They're going to Utah. They're even coming out to the Intermountain West, to places like Boise and certainly Denver. And they're Salt Lake. They're looking for a better quality of life, safe streets, schools that actually teach, politicians that aren't crooked. So back in the day, we had six teams in the NHL. You look at it now, you know, there's three NHL teams in California. We got them in North Carolina, I think Tennessee. We got them in Texas. They're all over the place. And it shows in a roundabout sort of backhand way, my theory of the NHL and, you know, urban competition is the places where you've seen new NHL franchises pop up in the last 10, 20 years, not so coincidentally, are the centers for growth in this country, right? It's where a lot of corporate relocation and household relocation is occurring for important reasons. So if Chicago and New York and Newark and Detroit and Cleveland and St. Louis and Philadelphia and those cities cannot start to pull it together and can not start to engineer a new politics where the teachers' union does not run the show totally in the public schools, if they cannot start to engineer a new environment for policing where police are not the bad guys, you know, where the bad guys are the bad guys, if they cannot start to do things like this and attack the endemic corruption, at least in places like Chicago, and change some very rigged rules of governance that, like, nobody ever talks mm-hmm. about, but I do in my book, if they can't do these things, you know, they're going to be toast in 10 years. So that's kind of, you know, the call to arms. And then when I saw things going sideways during the civil unrest, quote unquote, in 2020, I felt I had to come back here. And that's sort of how this book got started.
And we're going to cover the book and we're going to promote the book. But I wanted to touch on three topics. Number one is Beetlejuice. They call her Beetlejuice Lightfoot, the mayor of Chicago, who has been in utter disgrace as a mayor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I thought the days and Rahm Emanuel, who were the previous mayors of Chicago, were horrible. This person, mm-hmm. Beetlejuice, has taken over. During her tenure as mayor of Chicago, crime mm-hmm. is up. Just this year, 16%. 2,500 people have been shot in the city of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, her policies have basically pushed people out of Chicago and out of the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on the current mayor, Lori Beetlejuice Lightfoot?
I talk about Lori Lightfoot a lot in my book, but to answer you, so, I mean, you can't not talk about Chicago under her administration. It has been a complete disaster. Now, to me, there's some nuance here. So it's useful to consider the background. She is an intelligent, accomplished woman. She worked as a U.S. assistant attorney for the federal prosecutors in Chicago. She put corrupt Chicago aldermen in jail. She's a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School, my old neighborhood of Hyde Park on the south side where I grew up, a fascinating place. So many people have come from there. Barack Obama just adopted the neighborhood. He was a latecomer. But, you know, give Barack his due. So Lori was beloved by the good government groups. Everybody was happy to see her come in, intelligent, accomplished, worked on hot potato police accountability issues, not a nobody, very good civic resume, smart woman, lifted herself up from difficult circumstances in her childhood in Ohio. She grew up poor. So there was every reason to expect that when she said she would bust up corruption and make fixing the rigged rules of the game her number one priority, there was every reason for everybody to fall all over themselves. And they did, and she got elected, and then she folded right away under pressure. As soon as the riots and looting started after George Floyd, she was not prepared. The city was not prepared. And the minute she came under fire from the aldermen for the out-of-control crime and violence on the streets, she immediately lost her cool, and she's been losing her cool ever after. But worse than that, if you really want to get, in my mind, to the nub of what makes your administration such a disaster, I can think of two things. Number one is the preoccupation with systemic racism, when what we really have now is systemic misrule at the hands of an urban political elite that is increasingly of color. We've got a black mayor. We've got a black chief judge of Cook County, Tim Evans, who deserves much more abuse than he gets. It's all focused on the prosecutor, our George Soros prosecutor, Kim Fox, who deserves, you know, plenty of criticism for things that she's done to contribute to lawlessness and a lack of consequences for serious violent criminals. But Tim Evans is the guy who set the course on bail reform. So Evans, Lightfoot, and Fox, top important officials in Chicago and Cook County, all black. City Council, 32 Latino and black aldermen, 18 white. So what we have here, with everything going wrong, broken courts, broken schools, broken finances, and really a broken public dialogue with this official preoccupation of systemic racism, what we really have is this urban political elite of color running the city right into the ground. This is a city where black lives don't matter, you know, and it's because of the people in charge. They do nothing to change things around, to create an environment where police can do their jobs. They do nothing to put violent criminals away when they should be put away. Instead, they let them out on $250 or $500 bond before their trial for gun charges or carjacking, and they go right out all too often and do this same stuff all over again. Sometimes guys who've been let out on low cash bond for gun violations, which, by the way, is not a serious crime, according to our state's attorney, not a serious charge, they'll go out and kill people. And then you've got 2,000 people leaving anguished comments on a Facebook page. I've literally seen it. It's people are at their wit's end, and black people are talking about black-on-black crime, but our black leaders say we're not allowed to talk about it. And it affects everybody. Obviously, I'm a white guy. You know, there's just a whole lot here that's awful. We're all Chicagoans. We're all people. We're all sons and daughters and mothers and fathers, grandparents and grandchildren. And when you see black community elders being killed in Chicago in a parking lot because some punk comes up and tries to carjack their car and then punches them in the head and they die. And this happened in Hyde Park a month or two ago. A guy was a veteran, 73, going to buy groceries to go over to his daughter's house and have dinner with his daughter and granddaughters. And just like that, and it turns out the two young men that did it, you know, had priors, and one was on probation, thanks to Kim Fox. So it's Lightfoot, but it's Fox too, and it's also Tim Evans. And we can't even talk about it. We can't call out black leaders for failing black people because it might be racist to say so. So we're living, you know, in a place with funhouse mirrors. Everything is distorted, and we can't even get started on an honest conversation. But here's the good news, sort of bleeding through all of this. People are starting to say enough already, you know, basta, right? It's just no more. There's
no more.
Something brewing here. Now, how far it'll go, I can't say, but people are fed up. I got to tell you, people in Chicago are completely fed up.
People all over. You know what, gentlemen? I challenge anyone to produce the name of any urban Democrat mayor that has bettered their city. And I think it's going to be a blank sheet. You know, I don't see anyone coming up with anything, any state, for God's sakes, that these Democrats seems to lead. And that's because of the Marxist influence in their party. And like we said at the top of the show, the Marxist goals are just the destruction and degradation of Western and American and Christian civilization and economy.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, gentlemen,
mm-hmm.
because no one's going to come up with a name, right? There's no names. I can't think of any city improved with Democratic leadership. And some of these cities have had Democrat leadership for decades, like Chicago. I mean, what is it, 60, 70 years of
The last Republican mayor in Chicago left office in 1931. It's been a while. But, you know, I got to say, I agree with you. And I want to throw this out there myself. I'm a cantankerous independent, right? I'm not even a Republican. I voted for Democrats. I voted for Republicans in my now many decades on the surface of this planet. And there are Democrats out there. I've seen them. I call them charter school Democrats. I've seen them in Washington State, where I've lived for a good part of the last 20, 30 years. And, you know, there are Democrats who know how to do the right thing. And, yeah, no disrespect to Curtis, but if Eric Adams gets in, he'll be in a way a role model. How he'll actually perform will be another matter. But I don't think that we can sit here holding our breath, whether we're, you know, Democrats, Republicans, or independents, waiting for a Republican political resurgence in the big cities. That's not going to be how change happens. I think it's got to be more of a bottom-up rising. And it starts in the home. It starts with faith and family cohesion, and it's the total opposite of what's been programmed into everybody. And the funny thing is, you know, it's not just, quote, the kids and the students in college. The people who are running our cities now, you know, the 40 and 50-year-olds in City Hall who run the departments and put out the reports and set the official tone and rhetoric, they came up in college when a lot of this Marxist socialist stuff had already taken hold. So their entire worldview is shaped by this sort of redistributionist, identity politics-driven agenda that's essentially been everywhere but the hard sciences, you know, for the last 40 or 50 years in academia. And it's even creeping into the hard sciences now, amazingly enough. Yep. So it's very much a case of the universities have been poisoning this, and it's not coincidental. They knew that this was the place to go to start to change. You know, here we see people being shut down. You know, there are things you can't even talk about. There are campaigns to cancel people. There was a newspaper columnist, a great guy, and actually he does still a radio show when he's out on his own now, a guy named John Cass, who was at the Chicago Tribune. He took over after Mike Royko left off, the legendary Chicago columnist. Well, Cass became conservative over the years, and a year or two ago he wrote a column where he called out essentially the Soros prosecutors, you know, these county prosecutors like Kim Fox, who have actually gotten campaign funding from George Soros, but who all have this approach of going light and going easy on serious criminals. So he called out something glaring and obvious, and guess what happened? Nine of his fellow staffers at the Chicago Tribune, reporters who were in the Newspaper Union Guild, wrote a public letter calling for his column to be moved off of page three because by calling out Soros and his agenda, he was being anti-Semitic. And it was ridiculous. But it turned into a huge thing. There was this whole effort to cancel John Katz over calling out something obvious. And there was nothing in that column that was anti-Semitic in the least. And many Jewish people, you know, spoke up to defend him. But it's what happens now. You know, if you talk about inconvenient truths, you're going to be labeled a racist or a hater of some kind.
Yeah.
So it's a way of cheating. And I'm bringing this up because I think it goes along with the poisoning of minds, the minds who now run our cities in the university. You know, there is no tolerance of debate. There's no tolerance of really diversity of thought. So diversity turns out to be a fairly shallow concept, in my opinion.
Definitely. Matt, we have 254. You have a question for Matt Rosenberg.
A comment. I think that it's become an American problem with all these cities that have so much crime going on. It's no longer a Republican or just a Democrat. It is an American problem.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that wholeheartedly. We're all in this together, and the dichotomy is disturbing sometimes. I was downtown looking at the great, beautiful skyline last Saturday night, watching a great blues concert to celebrate the 50th anniversary of a great local record label here called Alligator Records. Puts out some of the best blues music in the world. Started right here 50 years ago out of a guy's car trunk. So a friend of mine who was with me said, look at this, Matt. This is why Chicago is still a brilliant place. The beautiful skyline, the great music, the fresh breeze coming off Lake Michigan, thousands of happy people. There's still a lot of good here. And I thought, yeah, you got a point. Then later, I said to myself, how many people got shot this weekend, Matt? How many people died? And, of course, they're doing updates every weekend, you know, every 4 hours. So Monday morning is when the real count comes down. And it was a good week, good weekend. We only had 56 people shot and 9 killed. And so to me, So to me, that's an American problem. That's a Chicago problem. It's not a white problem, a black problem, Republican, Democrat, or independent, or libertarian. It's just a problem. And, you know, we depend on tourism, among other things. The mayor was talking about putting a casino downtown. Well, now we've got armed robbery crews jumping out of carjacked SUVs and relieving like 20 people of their wallets and cell phones over the course of like 2 hours. We've got random stabbers on the side, on the sidewalks. There was a guy with a hammer on the CTA train, the Red Line, the north-south transit spine of our city, and he had priors for going at bus passengers with knives. You know, it's just like, this is a problem that transcends all labels. I completely agree with the caller.
Matt, please promote your book and your website.
Absolutely. So my book is called What Next Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son. So it's for sale mainly on Amazon. So this is print on demand. So we got to market very quick, but the conditions were it's basically at Amazon. So save your Amazon complaints for another day, good folks. Some of my friends have given me that. And I'm like, hey, they let me turn around this book in about 3 weeks. You know, it was fantastic. So go to Amazon, search for What Next Chicago at Amazon, and my website, where you'll find a lot of good reading and also a purchase link for the book, is called chicagoschooled.com, and that's schooled with a K. ChicagoSchool.com. You'll find great pictures of Chicago. You'll find some long essays by me about Chicago corruption and crime and growing up here. And the book, again, at Amazon, What Next Chicago. Also, I'm on Twitter at Chicago Schooled with a K in Schooled.
Definitely. We'll promote your book on our website.
I appreciate
that. We definitely. We have to also include that Chicago has one of the strictest gun laws in the nation. Yes. The crime wave continues.
It does. And there's this illusion that if we just ratchet up the gun laws and make them somehow more strict, which is not really possible because there were efforts to make them even tighter that were defeated in legal challenges in years past, that if you somehow manage to ratchet up the gun laws and make them even tighter and harder, that this will change things. And the thing is, and it's the oldest thing in the world, any cop will tell you, anybody with any street savvy will tell you, criminals don't play by our rules. So, you know, the guns are not going to stop. And Chicago police are actually doing a pretty darn good job interdicting illegal guns. They're seizing thousands upon thousands of illegal guns, but they just don't stop coming in. And I always like to reverse engineer things. When you peel this thing back and walk it back and back and back, the real problem here is that young men, almost always young men of color, are using guns on each other for really, really lousy reasons. And if you trace it back, you know, they're shooting each other literally over rap videos. We've got this rap style here called Chicago Drill. And, you know, the name is unfortunately all too real because people will disrespect some other gang member in a video that gets a rap video posted to Insta or Twitter or even Facebook. And then guys will come out on a block because everybody knows where everybody else lives, right? And they'll just spray the block. So there's no impulse control. And there's a really funny concept of respect. So, you know, that's what's really going on. So we need young men to be raised in such a way that they don't resort to guns the instant they feel threatened or insecure. So to me, that's the problem. It's not changing the gun laws. And it's another example of sort of distorting the debate. You know, Lightfoot loves to talk about our gun problem and our racism problem. She doesn't talk about our child-rearing problem because she'd have to put too much skin in the game, and there's no easy win there real quick, whereas if you denounce racism, well, boom, you're a social justice hero to a certain sector of the electorate. And, you know, three-quarters to two-thirds of the electorate here does not vote in our local elections, even though we get 70% of registered voters at the presidential elections. We have our local elections in odd-numbered years in February and April. And I understand from a friend who lives in Queens, a former cop who's a professor of criminology at John Jay University, really cool guy named Peter Moskos. He wrote a book called Cop in the Hood because for his PhD dissertation, he was a Baltimore cop for 1 year. We were talking on the phone not so long ago, and I had a chance to interview him and soak up some of his wisdom, which I tried to reflect adequately in my book. Peter's a real neat guy, and I was talking to him about the timing of the local elections in Chicago, and he said, "God damn, we got the same thing going on here in New York, and we also have really low turnout in our local elections." And you know who votes? It's the public employee union members and a large handful of white progressives, and everyone else is sitting it out. So I think, you know, to elect a politician who will call out family breakdown, who will call out gang culture, who will call out the teachers union, it's going to take, and again, we come back to we're all in this together, never mind about political party or race. in this case, it's going to take more people in communities of color stepping up and voting and getting into that old-fashioned civic engagement. We need a dramatically higher voter turnout in cities like Chicago and New York and many of the other failing cities, dramatically higher voter turnout in the local election. It's easy to vote for president. I think the solution in Illinois and Chicago is to change state law so that Chicago would be allowed to have its local elections at the same time, exact same days, as the presidential primary and the presidential general election. That would be an absolute game changer, and the powers that be don't want that. So, you know, in my book, I try to get at some of the practical things we can do about rig rules, about expanding school choice, about better policing strategies like going back to more foot patrols. It's not completely hopeless, and you guys know this also. I try to shine a light on success stories, families that have made it, you know, former gangbangers that turned their life around, young women who were teenage mothers, single, all alone, working in Burger King, who managed to completely turn their life around. And, for instance, in the case of one woman I got to meet and write about, become a realtor and then an entrepreneur running a Christian home school. You know, there are all kinds of fantastic success stories. There was a whole class of young black women who just graduated from a training course as electricians, certified electricians. Mm. Who doesn't want to see something like that happening, right? This is down in Woodlawn on the south side, just south of Hyde Park, right near where the Barack Obama Presidential Library is going to go in, is one of the hardest hit neighborhoods in the whole city of Chicago, Woodlawn. And there's a pastor there named the Reverend Corey Brooks, who's just dealing it. He's doing great things. And he was the one who set up this class for black female electricians. So, you know, there's literally a million points of light. We just got to find them, sing their praises, and get real about families, faith, you know, family cohesion, and parents doing their jobs. Nobody wants to talk about that. It's too old-fashioned, and you got to put too much skin in the game. So I say that absolutely has to change.
Definitely. 732-539, do you have a question for Mr. Rosenberg? No, it's this time. Poverty rate, Matt, in Chicago as of today, 20.6 rate. One in four individuals in Chicago are living below the poverty level. That's another failure by a progressive mayor that, you know, we've been told that the progressives are very, very passionate and compassionate about the poor. And for such a long time, urban cities have not progressed the way they should have progressed. Poverty, run down, broken down, drug-infested areas continue to be part of the living of these neighborhoods and these urban cities.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone assumes that just because a minority would come into play and be the center of attention and be the head of the local government, everything would change in every urban city.
Yeah,
that's been a total failure.
You know, you raise two very important issues. One is this idea of representation by race, and that's something we're dealing with now in the remap. That's a little bit of inside baseball. Maybe we'll have a chance to get to that in a minute. But to your main point about what I call ghost neighborhoods and poverty, I learned some interesting things when I went deep into the South Side in late 2020. You know, I moved into Bridgeport, which is the ancestral Irish neighborhood, and it used to be quite racist. It's more diverse now, in a really interesting place. And you see a lot of what makes Chicago vibrant there, but I went much deeper into the South Side. I saw a real great turnaround in a neighborhood called Pullman, where they used to make the Pullman sleeper cars for the railroad. Fascinating place.
Oh, wow.
There's a new national monument there. But for the first part of the 20th century, Pullman was riding high, and there was a black middle class. There was beautiful Victorian townhomes. Things started to slide toward the middle of the century, and by 1980, it was a very hard hit, poverty-stricken neighborhood. There was a big turnaround started around 2010, 2013, and this was still in the time of Daley II and then Rahm Emanuel. Some good things did happen under the watch of each, even though overall a lot of things got worse. They had a large land parcel they redeveloped with something called New Market Tax Credits and something called Tax Increment Financing, which is often misused in Chicago but was used well in Pullman. And they took an old industrial brownfield site, turned it into a great office park with a lot of new jobs. But more importantly than that, the Chicago Neighborhoods Initiative, CNI, started a micro-lending program. So guess what's happening in Pullman? They're lending money almost entirely to borrowers of color. Many of them are ex-convicts. And what are many of them borrowing money for? $20,000 or $40,000 at a pop only? They're starting delivery fleets. They're starting own small package delivery companies. Yeah, Amazon works you like a dog, that's for sure, but you can make real money, and they don't care if you have a record. They show if you show up and manage to do volume every day on your delivery runs, right? That's what it's all about. They're even doing training, the Chicago Neighborhood Initiatives. It's a community development corporation, and that's a type of beast that I think can be very crucial in revitalizing some of these neighborhoods. They're doing training in penal institutions. And the number one thing they hear from guys who are still in there is, I want to get a job driving a truck somehow or other. And where a lot of them end up on the South Side is doing this kind of work. So that's great. That creates stable homes, stable incomes. It's a great thing. But then you've got about 10 to 15 neighborhood downtowns that are totally gone. They're around the bend. They're scary, scary places. But back in the 70s, they were absolutely vibrant. So that was when we had a middle class, and particularly a black middle class in Chicago. So how to bring back these neighborhoods is a real conundrum. Without going into all the details, I can tell you that if people buy the book and read it, they will read one fascinating and, frankly, very colorful case study of a neighborhood right next to Pullman that's grappling with what I just discussed. It once was great. Now their neighborhood downtown is shot. It's a neighborhood called Roseland. It's very near where Barack Obama used to do some work as a community organizer. And the very same Michigan Avenue that you guys know about, because it's part of our fancy downtown area in Chicago, that very same Michigan Avenue goes another, 5, 10, 15 miles down to Roseland. That same Michigan Avenue looks like Syria or Somalia when you get to Roseland. And I walked it, and I talked to people, and I looked at what was going on there. Guys tried to sell me drugs. There's fly dumping. Everything's burned down. There's a few businesses, black-owned businesses, that have been there for years, real troopers. They're still there. There's a donut shop that's been there 50 years. But it's absolutely gone to seed. And the thing is, they have historic architecture there, right? And they're right next to this brand new national monument in Pullman, where they refurbished all the old factories and a beautiful old clock tower that were part of the Pullman rail car complex. And then just a few miles up the road is going to be the great new Barack Obama Presidential Center. And it will be a grand facility and very beautiful, even though it's been controversial because they're rerouting some streets and they've taken parklands for it. I think it'll be a plus along with the new national monument in Pullman. Roseland is right next to all this good stuff that's been happening in Pullman. In my book, I kind of put down a marker, and I say if Chicago cannot manage to do a turnaround in Roseland, which is emblematic of like 10 or 12 other black neighborhood downtowns that need to be brought back to life, if we can't pull this off in the Roseland community on the south side of Chicago, I don't know where we can pull it off because it has so much going for it. So you're quite right to focus on urban poverty, and a lot of it goes back to the neighborhood, and it doesn't all come from City Hall and developers and tax breaks. The people in the community have to step up. They really have to step up. So that starts with mom and dad and junior. It starts with the city schools, too, that Lori Lightfoot will not fix and that she has been willfully making worse. So, you know, it all turns into one big ball of yarn in a way in the end. The schools, the economy, the political leadership, the political rhetoric. And, you know, we've got about like 7 or 8 moving parts here, right, including the city budget and public employee pension fund debt, which I'm sure is an issue you guys know about because it's endemic to all these Democratic-run cities. So it's all a big ball of yarn with many strands, right, that are all tangled up together. And if you mess up one or two things, you're in a bad way. But if you're messing everything up, you know, you're really behind the eight ball. So I think the poverty and the lack of opportunity, you know, leads to crime. The lousy public schools help lead to crime. Absent parents help lead to crime. And the prevailing progressive rhetoric, you know, tries to paint it all over, right, with happy faces. And it's there's not a happy face to be seen in these neighborhoods. So there's just a whole lot of work to do, a great lot of work to do.
I personally wish Chicago the very best because I've been to Chicago quite a bit for work, and it's a great city. And I got a chance to go to Lake Geneva, you know, which a lot of people from Chicago spend a lot of time there. But one of the things that I wanted to touch on, because we got 7 minutes to go, the police officers. This year the city of Chicago has had 363 police officers who have left. That's more than the number who retired the previous year. The constant defund the police, that is not going to make the city of Chicago or any urban cities. I mean, Minneapolis, St. Paul, the Twin Cities, New York, all the urban cities have been pushing. It's going to continue to make these cities worse when it comes to crime by this defunding the police.
There is a very hostile atmosphere toward police among many segments of the community, and that is the reason that they are leaving. They're feeling it in, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 different ways, and it affects how they do their work too. They don't poke their nose into stuff that formerly they would have and that we would want them still to be poking their nose into. If a guy is in an alley looking around and acting furtively at 2 or 3 in the morning before this hostile atmosphere toward police became so entrenched, most cops would go approach the guy and say, hey, what are you doing? They would check it out. Now they let him pass. This kind of thing is going on in New York, too. I learned from my friend and my source, Peter Moskos. It's going on in a lot of other cities. And, yes, they are leaving in droves. And, I mean, I think we all agree, you know, George Floyd was not the only example. Police can screw up just like, you know, a factory worker or a teacher or a politician can screw up. Police are human too. They make mistakes. And when they do and when it's really clear, they deserve the consequences. And we've seen that happen in Chicago, and it was justified. But this idea that we're going to paint all police as, you know, you've seen the phrase ACAB, right? You know what those letters stand for. You've seen the signs that say F12, right? We've seen people torching police vehicles at peaceful protests, excuse me, mostly peaceful protests, you know, for BLM. And and there's just this generalized attitude of very deep disrespect toward the police. And guess what? You go into a place like, say, Englewood on the south side. I met a man named Daryl Smith there, a 51-year-old black man. He was the guy in the summer of 2020 who, when the BLM protesters came into Englewood to the local police precinct, which Daryl helped build along with his friends in the laborers' union, which he busted wide open for black people, which is a whole nother great success story, breaking open the white construction unions in Chicago. Daryl and his friends, other middle-aged black men, went there and told the white and black younger protesters, you know what? Get out of here. We don't want to defund the police. We want more police in our neighborhood. And what I'm hearing from black people on the South Side when I went to research my book is, they want two things. They want more police, and yes, they want better police. They saw what happened in the Laquan McDonald case. That was a very famous and clear case of police misconduct, and Emmanuel tried to cover it up and hide public release of the videos, the body cam videos and the dash cam videos, until after he won re-election. It left a really lousy smell. He deserved more or less most of the grief that he got for that. People know about that stuff, but they want more and better police. And so this was really interesting to see middle-aged black men telling the younger protesters, no, man, you got it wrong. You don't speak for the community. So this kind of stuff is starting to iterate in Chicago, and you have other people, black elders, middle-aged black people, stepping up and speaking out. And actually, in the new budget that she proposed, I haven't gotten deeply into it yet, but just in the last couple of days, Mayor Lightfoot proposed a new budget for the next fiscal year. There's actually an increase in police department funding, and I can tell you this, and I dug up some of the reports and referred to them in my book. The book has 348 footnotes, by the way. It's pretty deeply researched, but I tried to make it very readable. And if you do read it, I think you'll agree. It's both scholarly and streetwise, and I'm very proud of how it turned out.
Definitely.
And I'll let the readers be the judge. But one thing that's in there, there's been a lot of reporting on this now. Cities are increasing their police budgets. In essence, if you crunch the numbers in a certain way, like percentage of city budget that goes toward policing rather than total dollar amount, defund the police is failing. If you look at the 50 largest cities, and Bloomberg News Service did an analysis of this a few months ago, the defund movement is not catching on. So there's the rhetoric, but the reality is slightly, at least, in the opposite direction. People don't want to defund.
We're almost done, Matt. I appreciate it. You have to come back. There's a lot more that we need to talk about. But thank you again for taking time to be on the program tonight.
It was my absolute pleasure. It was great talking to you guys. I hope we can talk again.
Okay. All right, Matt. Thank you. Good night.
Great. Have a good evening. God bless America. Next week we'll have another exciting guest, just like Matt Rosenberg, tonight on Block Talk Radio, the Cisco and Falstone Hour. Good night.